You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome back, queers. This is season 3, episode 6 of Thesis on Joan. Thesis on Joan is a podcast dedicated to amplifying voices from the LGBTQ plus community in the New York performing arts scene and examining the industry from a queer perspective. Join us as we sit down with groundbreaking theater folks, both on stage and behind the curtain. For many queers, theater has been an escape, and this podcast looks to have open conversations on where we've come from and where we're headed as a community while queering the canon along the way. Hello, queers. Happy end of Pride. We hope everyone is looking forward to an even queerer summer ahead. So speaking of summers and breaks and all that wonderful stuff, we will be taking our annual hiatus after this episode. We will be back in early fall with lots more interviews, some takes on new theater. So stay tuned, enjoy the next month, month and a half, and we promise we'll be back before you even know it. In the meantime, feel free to message us on Instagram, share any shows that we should know about. We, of course, want queer culture recs, even when we're not making the show. So before we jump into our interview today, we wanted to share with you all that friend of the show, Roger Q. Mason, just had a new play announced. So we wanted to give you information in case your summer travels take you to Los Angeles. So Roger Q. Mason's play, Lavender Men, will premiere with Skylight Theater and Playwrights Arena in Los Angeles, August 6th through September 4th. The genre-pushing play courageously reimagines one of America's most beloved historical icons, President Abraham Lincoln, through a queer person of color's storytelling lens. The production will also be accessible to a national audience via streaming performances beginning August 20th. Visit www.lavendermenplayla.com for more information and to purchase tickets, and we will have a link in our show notes to that. So just a heads up before we start our interview with the incredible Queen Jean, this was recorded the first preview of Soft at MCC, which was just extended through July 17th. So Soft is by Donja R. Love, directed by Whitney White, and Queen Jean has done the costumes. So you can hear some noises in the background as they get ready for their first performance. So that's what's happening there. But we encourage everyone to get out and see Soft before it closes. It's a New York Times critics pick. And after this episode, we think you'll definitely want to check it out. Also, Queen Jean hints at some projects with the Black Trans Liberation Movement that she didn't want to share before Pride since this was recorded in May. So you can check out more information about that in our show notes. Definitely pay attention to the Black Trans Liberation Kitchen. And now without further ado, the incredible wisdom of Queen Jean. The Revelator. Queen Jean is a New York City-based costume designer who has designed over 50 shows and counting. She has fully committed her voice to the advocacy of marginalized communities, emphasizing Black trans people. She is currently among few costuming professionals in the NYC theater who live their trans identities out loud while making an effort to ensure she is not the last. Queen founded the Black Trans Liberation in 2020. The organization aims to provide access and employment resources for the TGNC community. Through this work, she has organized community events, protests, and mutual aid drives to denounce the actions of a disenfranchised system and call for an end to racism and white supremacy. She is a firm believer in the preservation and support of Black trans people and a testament to how one can thrive when adequately paid, supported, and loved. Hire the girls is her motto. In 2021, Queen was MoMA PS1's Artist in Residency and co-curated Memoriam and Deliverance. This installation called awareness of the last 5 years of transphobic and fatal violence while celebrating Black trans leaders in the community. She was also the opening speaker for the March on Washington, March on for Voting Rights. Queen has an MFA in design from NYU Tisch.
Hello, Queen Jean. Welcome to Thesis on Joan. We are so excited to be talking with you today.
Hello.
So we like to start with our guests sharing their name, pronouns, and anything else you'd like to share about how you identify.
Absolutely. Hi, everyone. Good evening. My name is Queen Jean. Pronouns are she and her, and I show up in this world as a unapologetic Black trans femme coming from Haiti. And I show up in this world also as a storyteller an educator, and also a revelator, revealing a lot of spiritual truths that people may be hiding from, may not be ready to come to terms with, but we can unpack it together. So yeah, that's me, Queen.
And you're a costume designer, and you've designed both for new work and revivals, including Shakespeare. How is your approach different for new work versus revivals, and do you prefer one over the other?
No, actually, I don't think I have a preference. I mean, I think they both actually, oddly enough, require the same amount of, you know, mental space and level of, you know, research and process and collaboration, ultimately. And I would say that I think what I find exciting, potentially, I think with the new projects is that it is truly a really earnest time that you can create. You often may have access, right, to a writer who you can, you know, have a lot of information from. We often are dealing with pieces that sometimes might even feel autobiographical. So it's helpful that, like, there are references that, you know, you can often pull from, things that you can actually use for deeper meaning, for contextualization, all of those. So that to me is really exciting. And honestly, it's one of those things that, like, we don't have any rules, honestly. I think oftentimes with the revivals or with, you know, a previous work or the reimagined Shakespeare's, you know, as a society, I think we all have this idea, all right, of what we're expecting to see, you know, when we go to, you know, to a Hamlet or, you know, I mean, there are like a lot of imprinted, I think, ideas about character. And sometimes you can really reimagine it, right? And it actually then feels like a new form of theater, you know? I think, you know, casting can help with that. Sometimes cultural landscape or, like, geographical settings or just, you know, re-envisioning also allows for the audience and for the community to actually maybe see it through a different lens. So sometimes that's also really exciting, I think.
And you also design for opera, dance, film. Yeah. What are the different things you have to consider when going to these different mediums?
Oh, that's a great question. I think when traveling, right, between different performance spaces and mediums of expression, the true difference, I think, lies in sometimes with, like, the collaborators. And that I think a choreographer and a director often, you know, serve a similar function, right? And that there is a strong vision that we as the collaborators are really supporting, following, uplifting, amplifying, deepening as well. So that I think is a commonality. And then I would say in terms of differences, sometimes ultimately, like, I will say this, I think the main difference is the level of durability, right? Mm-hmm. An item or a costume or an article of clothing may need to have. I think for dance piece or sometimes with operas or things that have a high level of physicality, there are differences structurally how, as a designer, I would approach either one of them. So, you know, if we're doing, you know, Three Sisters or, you know, a piece of good old Ibsen or Chekhov, you know, those folks aren't really, you know, their sense of time and purpose is quite different as opposed to if it is a piece, you know, we could say by Bilty Jones. So I recently had the honor and pleasure to collaborate with two different forms of medium and two different ways to start. So I think that's the main difference. And I also say, but the stories often feel familiar and they can even echo. They feel the same. And oftentimes the people who are embodying these characters or storytellers, the folks that are, you know, being the shepherds, right, of this vision, you know, that often we can find a lot of parallels between them. You know, they're still humans. They're still, you know, they still have feelings. and most importantly, they also have a voice in the collaboration. They will give amazing and sound input that I think really helps me as an artist and as a collaborator to make my work stronger, to make our work stronger, right? How the piece wants to move, how the piece is going to shift, even from the first act to the second act, what level of transformation may be included in that conversation. So that to me, I think, is also like a similarity.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. And you frequently collaborate with the director, Whitney White. And can you tell us more about your work together and what makes a good collaborative relationship between a director and a designer for you?
Oh my gosh, that is such a great question. I think what makes a great collaboration between a director and an artist is trust and communication. I mean, I think honestly, it's like any old relationship, okay? We got to know what's going on. We got to know that, you know, that the individual that you are sharing space with, right, that you're holding space with ultimately, that there's a good rapport, that there's great positive energy, and trust in that you can, you know, relay your ideas, your impulses, and that they embrace them. And sometimes they might even like manifest them into something else. And so for me, you know, that can manifest into some sketches. It can manifest into, you know, something being draped on like a good form. you know, I mean, it can manifest, you know, from like a magazine clipping, or, you know, we could be like, hey, I actually just saw this movie, or, but again, that is something that, I think what I would also add to that is like the development over time. I think that's what makes such a great collaboration between a director, choreographer, filmmaker, and the artist that they're working with. And for me, as a designer. And so I would say that in terms of the trust, again, is that, that the language that we're both speaking, it doesn't always have to be the same. But there is a common denominator. There is a unifying principle, in the way that we're, approaching the work. And that we're both being able to listen. We're actually both excited, right, to actually have challenging questions if they arise, but also have some great time. You know, I mean, you know, you end up working very closely with the director, with the choreographer, or, you know, like a film artisan. And so what I often find makes for a good or a positive, you know, because collaboration, you know, is ubiquitous. And so... But I think for, you know, a lasting collaboration, what often helps is this idea of communication, and that the communication is not siloed. You know, I think everyone's really part of these ideas. Folks are woven in a little bit into what the process looks like, that it doesn't feel foreign. Folks aren't feeling like, when is this going to happen? But honestly, it is such a unique thing, I think, for each person. So, you know, we kind of allow for there to be air and for there to be room, you know, and how a collaboration happens. And, I think lastly, I'll just say that what I can say proudly and happily, is when you're collaborating with Whitney White, you're collaborating with a true, true visionary, with a comrade. You know, she exists in this world, not just as a director, but, you know, behind the scenes, you know, she's a philanthropist, you know, she's an educator, she's a mentor. She really is committed, on stage, backstage, wherever. And that to me is something that I'm really attracted to, as a human. You know, I like to know that the team and the family that I'm part of, the artistic family that I'm part of, fully sees me, right? Understands me. And again, we don't always have to speak the same language, but that there is a way for us to understand one another. And that, I think, allows for a good old time. Yeah.
It sounds like a dream match. It sounds like you guys are meant to work together. For sure. And you spoke a little bit about this already when you were talking about preconceived notions of characters when audiences come into the space.
Oh, yeah.
But are there other rules that you've given yourself the permission to break when it comes to designing?
Oh, absolutely. Babe, I don't live with the rules. I'll be quite frank. I think anyone that knows me knows, you know. And I think that there's joy in that. There's power in that. Also, as an artist, if we're creating rules, then why are we doing this work, right? To me, I'm not trying as an artist to limit what I have to say or to even funnel how I say it. I think that's not earnest or necessary. I will also say that I think as a creative, ultimately what we're doing can feel, right, can feel like a call to action, can feel like it's connected or aligned with a sense of spirituality, even divinity. You know, I think that, you know, folks have different alignments. And so I will say, I think for me personally, I don't think that rules help us. And quite frankly, rules are always meant to be broken. But I think that each new adventure, each new play, each new musical, each new idea, right, needs to have the full space of growth, of transformation, of resources, let's name that, in order for it to actually have the like the full breath that it needs, so that it can also take air and rise. And it might even, you know, grow bigger and beyond than what you maybe have imagined. And that, I think, is truly, you know, like the best scenario, you know, and honestly, then, you know, then you are blessed to be with a cast or an ensemble of people who also are ready to take that journey with you, right? Who may also be willing to embark, on this idea of a vision and to see it through. And I think for a lot of, communities of color, and particularly Black folks, Brown folks, we don't always get to have the space for our stories to be told, for our stories to be reimagined. It often comes out of strife or adjacent to whiteness. And it no longer has to be that way, quite frankly. And so for me, I think as an artist, I think that it is time for people to dream even bigger, even wider. And if there are rules, or if people feel like there are rules put in front of them, I think you can challenge them gracefully. And again, and it's not to be, you know, antagonistic, but if there is a way that we've been operating, if it doesn't work for everyone, I don't think that it serves us to continue to reimagine, oh, well, maybe we can do it this way this season, or next season it could be this way. Actually, no, it doesn't work. So actually, let's say it doesn't work. That's fine. If there are things or tools, or if there are even, you know, things that we can apply to a new idea, of course we can honor that. We don't have to reinvent the wheel all the way from the scratch. But I think if there, I think that there needs to be true reimagination, in some capacities. And again, this is not to, I think, be alienating or even to like be accusatory. I don't think that's what it is at all. I just think that in this time of awakening,
based costume designer post, who has designed over 50 shows.
I can't even say post pandemic because we are knee deep in it. Yes, it is. So we're actively in the pandemic, Black but post George Floyd, and knowing that there have been many George Floyds way before, there's been a Trayvon Martin, right? There's been a Marsha P. Johnson, right? And there has been many, many people of color, and particularly Black folks, who have been so marginalized and killed by this idea of like stagnant thinking about returning to a sense of the good old days. And, you know, we can ask ourselves, you know, did those days really, you know, were they good for everybody? And so I think that I'm excited. As a collaborator, as an artist, as an activist.
In 2021, Queen was MoMA PS1's to really reimagine how we tell stories, co-curated Memoriam and Deliverance.
And ultimately how we invest
in them.
This
installation called Awareness of the Last 5 Years. And how do we prepare ourselves for the responses. While celebrating Black trans
for the response, not only for the community, but the young artists who are, you know, actively seeing what was happening,
March on
right?
For voting rights.
I think in 10
Queen
years, you know, we will have to see,
NYU-Tish.
Right, a new language, a new wave of reaction from what folks are experiencing, living in a pandemic, living in a true civil war against race in this country, race, gender identity, sexuality, you know, women's reproductive rights, all of these things. I mean, it's something that we can't ignore. You know, the war against our AAPI community with relentless Asian hate and violence. As a community, we are going to respond. Mm-hmm. Folks are going to have stories of personal things that they've experienced, but also of things that we hope to see can be our future. And mm-hmm. that as a community, we can invest in that. Let's invest in that, right? We don't miss. And again, this is not to take away from Ibsen or a good old piece of Doll's House, but that may not be, you know, what could apply to my life or to my community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that this question started with, you know, your design work and got into your activism work, because those things are so interwoven and tied. And yeah, and it feeds into our next question. You've done this incredible work through the creation of Black Trans Liberation. And can you tell us more about the mission of your organization and what you all are doing?
Absolutely. Black Trans Liberation, for me, is a daily commitment. It is my fist in the fight. It is a dedication to not only uplifting, but truly creating access and sustainability for TGNC, trans and gender nonconforming folks, and particularly Black trans women, who we know are not only ostracized in society, but they face such a life-threatening life expectancy of the age of 35. And that is something that I'm deeply committed to ratifying, to actually really dismantling altogether. Black trans folks deserve to live, and they deserve to be able to have equitable ways to live, to be able to have a fair education, to not have to face job discrimination, housing discrimination, to not, you know, not need to continually face food inequities and insecurities when it comes to accessing those things, accessing those rights, not only as Americans, but as humans. Folks often want to disassociate that. And so actually, Whitney said something really beautiful. It's like, you know, somewhere down the line in our history and just of evolution, you know, for Black folks, Black women in particular, there's this idea that they're super strong, supernatural, but somehow that they're not human, or that they're subhuman, superhuman even, right? That they can withstand all types of pressures and forms of white supremacy and all types of oppression, so that they're superhuman, and then or even not human at all, anti-human. And so I think that that is something that I'm super aware of. Our community is aware of as Black people, but truly at this moment, centering Black trans voices and creating sustainable ways for them to not only survive, but to even potentially thrive. And so for me, for our organization, that shows up in forms of job security and equity, a lot of training, a lot of, you know, sitting down, right, with employers and different corporations, and even other organizations, right, who are, you know, willing at this point, right, or who are being asked, right, or demanded of, right, for real equitable change. And that's a great thing. I never want folks to feel like, oh, well, now we got to do this thing. You know, well, now the trans folks, I mean, first off, trans folks didn't just arrive onto the scene. That's a big misnomer. You know, we have always existed. We have never had space. And so now if we're calling for there to be equitable space, you know, we shouldn't feel like, oh, my God, you know, that like somehow community or artists are being burdened, right? The PWIs, as they were, I'm sure y'all know what that gives. but, you know, but it's not burdensome. I think folks really should, this is actually an invitation to do better, an invitation to deepen your work. A lot of, and this is not to just run off, but I think a lot of these organizations and facilities or these, you know, corporations, you know, if you go online or if you, you know, do just a little bit of reconnaissance, so much of their mission statements are rooted in global emotional care and equity and community preservation. And it's like, okay, but if we look, right, in your, like, we could even take it, you know, if we look at your board, right, we see what it's given. If we look at your staff, we see what that's given. And so it feels like there's a huge disconnect. And ultimately, what it feels like, you know, folks are relentless or sometimes reluctant, right, to really commit themselves to that change, to actually truly being inclusive and diverse, and it not just being part of a fad or just a wave, you know. This season, we're going to be, you know, inclusive and being diverse. No, I mean, it's a commitment. And there are really, and there are people, and there are, you know, that's happening. It's actually been happening way before the pandemic, but I think now we can't ignore it. And I think that that, again, is an invitation for us to continue doing that work, for us to recommit ourselves, right, to really making sure that Black lives, that all Black folks are no longer left in the margins of society, no longer left in the margins of your thinking, that they don't always have to be unhoused. And ultimately, and truly, this is a sentiment that I always think about, but because someone is homeless doesn't mean that they're hopeless, right? It means that the system has failed them. Systems have continually failed us. But we don't have to stay in that failure. We don't have to make excuses for the failure. We can actually start to repair and have a path of restitution, a path of care. Most importantly, you know, what does it look like for all these companies to, you know, to actually have a clinical therapist, right, on staff? Mm. You know, a series of them, right? We could have so there are ways for us to really invest, I think. Well, not I think, I know. There are ways for us to really invest in a really positive and equitable future that can exist. We can really start with the PWIs, right? Because we know that the grassroots folks, we've already been doing it, mm-hmm. right? We've already been instructionally and innately, right, dedicating ourselves to everyone. And not just the folks at the top, not just, you know, the folks that are in artistic position leaderships. you know, we know that at every tier in a business, a corporation, in a household, in every tier, everyone needs care. Everyone needs sustainability. Everyone needs a paycheck. Okay. Mm-hmm. Everyone needs to be greeted and loved on from the moment that they arrive. Everyone wants to feel that they matter. And this isn't to say, again, that, oh, well, one person is, you know, but if that's kind of what the benchmark is, right? We have an entire family or network of folks who need to have accessibility, permanent accessibility, right? Even a little piece of healthcare, that wouldn't hurt, you know? So I think that with the resources that we have, is there not a way to think, like, actually, how can we equally and fairly and adequately disperse those resources so that we don't always have folks that are always at the top, you know, that are thriving, so it seems. Or we can just mm-hmm. tell by the social media. Okay. You know, mm-hmm. we can start with Elon Musk. Hey, yeah. Brother. you know, but again, and again, you know, and just to that point, you know, I think that there's a huge understanding or, you know, folks would be like, well, you know, these folks are folks with money, you know, that they invest back in the community, right? That they make charitable contributions. But that's not a path towards liberation, right? A one-time donation doesn't save a community. An investment does, right? Mutual mm-hmm. aid does, right? If we stop, you know, if we give out, you know, a turkey, and again, this is not to be cynical, but if we only give out a turkey every Thanksgiving, you don't think that those folks are hungry? Mm-hmm. What if we gave out, you know, two or four turkeys every month?
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And speaking of mutual aid, you know, that was great. You led your protests at Stonewall, fighting for Black trans liberation. And can you tell us more about what Stonewall protest is continuing to do for the community?
So I was one of the founding organizers for the Stonewall protest. And, since like this past year, things have evolved, and I have also moved on from there. Mm-hmm. But the community is still there. I'm still part of that community. And so there's a deep commitment, obviously, to the core values, practicing, to unlearn a lot of the systemic forms of racism and systemic oppression that we are navigating, educating community about TGNC folks and about TGNC care and truly vitality in our community and liberation. And that really has manifested into Black trans liberation, full time. That's where I'm at. And then working with a lot of amazing community partners and other organizers and organizations, like Bridges for Life, which is founded by Tatiana Furman. And they are based out of New Jersey, work with Stop Killing Us campaign, which is a very powerful, dedicated work to ratifying the unfortunate, aggressive deaths of trans folks, and particularly trans women of color. And that is founded by Miss Lexi Fox, and as well as a lot of community organizations like GLITS, Gays and Lesbians Living in a Transgender Society, founded by Kyan Dorshow, the Black Trans Travel Fund, For the Girls, the Black Trans Femmes Collective. So there are many incredible folks that are modeling, right, that have spearheaded this idea of how do we connect our community to care? How do we create a sustainable way to put it together? And how do we ensure that folks aren't waiting, but they're just receiving the things and the care that they need? And so that's what, and so that's what the last, so that's where I've been committing myself. I truly feel deeply seated in my purpose, and that also manifests, as we know, in the mobilization of community protest, as well as, getting folks, on the front lines when it comes to the unfortunate murders that continually happen, unfortunately, right? Because we have not truly ended the thing, right? The police brutality will end when police end, but somehow we're not going to make that connection just yet. But I'm continually ready to educate and to implore folks to abolish the police. and truly, this is not jokingly, but I mean that with true sincerity. Recently we were down in Baltimore. There was a young high school student, Donnell Rochester, who was supposed to graduate this month, shot and killed by the police in February. And the community and the family were lied to. Information was withheld from them. Video footage then came out after they were actively pursuing them for information, for truth. And, video footage showed that what the police had alleged was incorrect, false. And that this young child was killed and shot and ultimately choked in their own blood while being handcuffed. And so it's those atrocities that really highlight the inequities and the true racism that is in with these systems of law, that we will not escape until there is truly a nationwide calling to action, a nationwide sense of true investment and reimagining what that looks like. I think a lot of folks, the Derek Chauvin trial, that team, they're trying to get a plea deal, right? To get his sentence reduced. Mm-hmm. And, this was the unfortunate murder that launched everyone into civil unrest. So there is truly, like, the system doesn't allow for there to be real permanent justice, equitable justice. And so therefore we have to reimagine the system, uproot it.
Yes. But
that means that we have to put something in place that is contingent and serves the entire community, that benefits and allows for the entire community to rise, and not just the folks at the top, not just the 1-2%. Okay, that little 1-2% milk, look, it'll always be there. But how do we make sure that everyone, right, is rising? How do we make sure everyone else is truly, you know, fortified in their growth? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that so directly can be applied to the theater community as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There are many correlations of white supremacy. Yeah. But again, you know, we don't have to stay there. You know, I think that's the thing. It's like, I mean, as we all know, I mean, there were so many artists, storytellers, proud, fearless individuals, honestly. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, and folks emerged and told their stories, spoke out their truths of the discrimination that they faced, of the inequities that they had to endure. And for a moment, it seemed that there was a true sense and care and investment in humanity, right? There was all these like organizations, you know, just like one-off things really now, it seems. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were, you know, commitments made. Statements made, I should say,
so many
again, like let me really get specific. A lot of statements were made about, you know, making this a better place for us to work and to live and to create. And I think, and this is not to be cynical or just not to be, but I'm just observing it. And it seems like, you know, we've made such a effort into the land acknowledgments, and that has been very consistent. But are we truly, you know, invested into our Indigenous communities? Like, are they partners of these institutions? What's going on? So again, I think that, and then on top of that, you know, we, have we truly centered the Black and Brown stories, the Black and Brown lives, the communities that have systemically, historically, all of those things been literally kept and shut out? Have we truly invested in them having a permanent seat at the table? Mm. And sometimes if it's not a table, that they have a permanent set of keys.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm looking forward to that.
Same.
But in the meantime, we're going to be jovial. We're going to continue to live and to be resilient because, you know, change doesn't happen overnight. I mean, a friend of mine jokes and says, girl, look how long it took, you know, for us to stop being segregated. And I was like, my dear, there are still parts of this country that are desegregated.
Yep.
So, and obviously, you know, we need to tell these lawmakers, policymakers, to keep their hands off of our bodies, right? I mean, it's all connected, the political and the personal, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if we are telling women and femmes what to do with their body, if the law is telling them how to conduct it's egregious. Mm-hmm. And we should not have to truly run out into the streets to call people in and to say, this is unacceptable. We should not have to worry that young trans youth are going to be somehow chastised, penalized. You know, parents will be considered, you know, abusers for trying to support their family and their loved ones.
Yeah.
It needs more than a reset at this point. I think, is, you know, there truly needs, again, to be an active investment and to not, you know, settling ourselves right back into the oppression that we just climbed up out of. Some of us are still trying to get up out of it. Mm-hmm. Some folks still have not been able to pay their rent. Do the folks in Flint, Michigan have clean water? Ooh. What's going on?
And like you're saying, it's not like the pandemic's over either. You know, it's
absolutely,
like it's all just still circling, and the talk keeps happening, or the talk stops. I feel like I've noticed that a lot with a lot of the organizations that were speaking up. It's like now that they're back in person, like you don't hear the promises anymore.
No. I mean, it's like, I actually love that. You know, the conversations have stopped, and what happens when the heartbeat stops? Maybe everything dies. You know, I think I had a colleague, I think maybe we were like having an open discussion similar to this kind of forum, right, about this idea of liberation, ultimately about revolution. And like, how does the revolution keep going? I said, the revolution never stopped. if at any point we thought the revolution stopped, right, somehow, okay, well, we got Trump out of the, you know, out of the White House. Boo, he might clamor himself right back in there. If we are not actively, again, being so vigilant and actively working towards true revolution, equitable, inclusive, intersectional revolution, we will find ourselves back out in the streets. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands off my body. Not going back to wire hangers. I mean, we will literally find ourselves regressing. You know, we want, you know, our marriage equality bills to come back. I mean, all of these things will be compromised. And no one wants that. Thank you all for taking time.
Oh my gosh.
I know this is a lot. I know this is supposed to be a quick conversation about artistry, but, you know, it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Do you have time for like a speed round of like our final closing sessions?
Oh, a speed round? Okay. I'll try to be quick. Too long-winded, but I can be quick.
No, we love it.
Yeah. So this part we call Queering the Canon. So is there a play or a musical work that you would like to see adapted in a queer way? And, or is there one that you would like to design for?
I've always been enamored by Sylvester and all the contributions that they made, right, to the scene and to community. So I don't know. I feel like something around Sylvester would be awesome. And I would love, honey, to adorn however way that that manifests. But yeah.
Amazing. For a queer culture rec, so outside of theater, what's your queer culture indulgence? And you can take that however you want.
Oh, I mean, okay, no shit, baby. Let me tell you, I love a poppy juice moment. Oh, yes, God. I love, you know, a poppy juice moment. And you know, I love to, you know, I think a good old queer cookout is where I'm best suited with my potato salad and pink lemonade and a piece of hot dog every now and then. Yeah, that's me.
I want that. Yeah, we do queer game nights, but Holly, maybe we should do a queer barbecue cookout soon.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Always. I'll come.
Yes, please.
We will invite you for sure.
Yeah. And you mentioned so many amazing organizations that we will link to and folks can follow. Is there one in particular that you would like to shout out that our listeners can support and potentially give to help their mission?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's no question. Black Trans Liberation. Yep. Okay. Tap right in. I mean, we're really excited. We have a lot of amazing partnerships and communal outreach endeavors. We have a lot of... I mean, look, I just want to like spill it now, but we have a lot of things that are coming out, around the first week of June, that I think are really, you know, align with our mission, but also, with the, you know, with the investment of our people, centering them and providing for them. So, folks, and please look out, tap in, support. You can support often as you'd like.
Definitely.
You know, you can support us well and you can support us often. I mean, we would love that. But so yeah, Black Trans Liberation.
Awesome. Cool. And I think the last thing is, how can people follow you online if you want them to follow you?
Well, absolutely. Hi everybody. I'd love, you know, to, you know, I like to connect. You know, I think that there's a lot of disruption that happens, but I think that we need to make a lot of connections. A great, you know, colleague, who gives, I think, a lot of insight, that oftentimes we think that this fight is, that this is one group's fight, right? Well, this is the queer struggle. This is the trans folks problem. This is the Black people problem. Instead of actually naming it and taking it on, no, this is our problem. You know, as a community, how can we be okay, right, with our with our Asian siblings constantly being harassed, being attacked, being stabbed? I mean, it is unbelievable that people are still operating with that type of hatred. That can't exist anymore. It needs to end. Trans and non-binary folks that are constantly in a war zone, that needs to end. You know, people deserve to live. People deserve to have a full access to everything. And it not just be a one-time package. No, we need daily and like investments and healthcare and the mental health resources to ensure that we not only are healing ourselves, but we're preparing ourselves, right, for the next part of this revolution. Vitality.
And is there, thank you for that. And is there a way for folks to follow you, like, on social media?
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes. You can follow me on social media. I have a Facebook, but I don't know what that's given. I have a MySpace. I don't even know if that logs in anymore. But you can definitely find me on Instagram. Instagram is Queen Jean, Q-W-E-E-N underscore J-E-A-N. And, again, that's Queen Jean, Q-W-E-E-N underscore J-E-A-N. And you'll find me. And all my thoughts.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. This was so so joyful and really inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, we thank you so much for giving us the time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. All right.
Thanks for listening. If you like, please rate and review us and share us with your friends.
So excited to hear your queer culture recommendations or any of your ideas on how we could queer the canon. You can call us, yes, actually call us and leave us a voicemail at 845-445-9251 or send us an email at thesisonjoan@gmail.com.
Until next time, keep it queer.
Not that it'd be that hard for y'all to do.
Okay, see, this was supposed to be speed.
No, it's
oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh.
I edited
it,
so it feels speedy. No, just kidding.
Yeah, okay.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.